Hello and welcome to Pontifex. I'm Fry.
And I'm Bree, ranking all of the popes from Peter to Francis. And this is episode 131, Pope Agapetus II. Agapetus.
Okay, the second Agapetus.
In our runs of like Johns and Leos and Stevens, it's nice to see an old callback, just like Marinus last week. We've got this little window of callback.
I like that you say like it's last week. It's been months, you guys.
It has been months. Yes, this is our first episode recording back since our small temporary hiatus to get Fry all settled in her new place. So congratulations, Fry.
Yes, I have my own place. It has a fireplace, which is silly because it is like 700 square feet and the fireplace takes up maybe like a huge chunk of it.
Look, you are allowed to be cozy now. So
I will be
enjoy.
So cozy. Except I don't know what's going on with this February. Why is it so warm? Where is my winter?
I mean, you say that.
It's going to be 60 degrees tomorrow.
I'm so happy that we're having a warm February over here. That's more what I should expect.
It's wrong and bad.
Yes, climate crises, they are wrong and bad. I think that is opinion we can all agree on. But yes, papal callbacks. It has been a long time, but it has been even longer since the last time we saw an Agapetus. And perhaps this callback is on purpose, because Agapetus's family was one with some history. So he was born in Rome sometime around 905 to a noble family, and his father was apparently a descendant of Anicius Faustus Albinus Basilius, a 6th century Roman official who was consul and chief magistrate in Rome in 541. So he had a very famous ancestor from about 400 years ago.
Okay, that seems a long time to be, you know, keeping up with that.
I mean, this is the Eternal City. We do have this stretch of history. And we do actually know a surprising amount about this notable ancestor. Because, interestingly, he was the last ordinary consul in Roman history. And ironically, he got mentioned in the Liber Pontificalis. So this goes all the way back to when the Ostrogothic king Totila was besieging Rome during Vigilius's papacy.
Oh, we're back to the Goths.
So long ago. So apparently Basilius and other members of the Senate fled the city when Totila broke through and went to the emperor in Constantinople, because that's the thing that happened that time. Quote, "Then some of the senators, Scythius, Albinus, and Basilius, patricians and ex-consuls, went to Constantinople and appeared before the emperor in their distress and desolation. And the emperor comforted them and enriched them as befitted Roman consuls." Which is ironic, because that's certainly better treatment than Pope Vigilius was going to get from the emperor, you may remember.
Yeah, I was going to say, isn't this the one where, like, people get arrested and all sorts of weirdness?
Dragged by his beard? Yes.
Yeah.
Escape through a castle at night? Yes. Mm-hmm. All of that. But back to this Agapetus, our current pope. We also know that Agapetus' mother was Greek, which is the more likely reason for his name. Because, as we said in Agapetus the First's episode, this is a Greek name meaning beloved. We don't know much about Agapetus' early life beyond that, or his early church career, other than the sources call him a man of, quote, wondrous sanctity. Like, he's known as Sanctissimus, which is like wonderfully
so
wondrous sanctity.
So much sanctity.
Yeah, so like very pious. The most.
It's like the opposite of scandal.
It's Scandalissimus and Sanctissimus. Oh, I'm working on a pope who could absolutely use that title right now. Anyways, we don't even know what titular church he might have been attached to, or if he was a cardinal priest before he was elected, or rather selected by Alberic, our patrician of the city, to succeed Marinus, and was consecrated as pope on May the 10th of 946. Now, before we move on to his papacy, I just want to include this little tidbit from Bartolomeo Platina, because the phrasing is just excellent and so captures the vibe. Agapetus II, a Roman, was created pope at a time when Italy was full of warlike hurly-burly.
Hurly-burly.
And he's right. During this period that we're going to be discussing, Italy is having a time. It is still fending off invasions from the Magyars, particularly around the Po River. And while we're not going to be dealing with this in a direct sort of manner, knowing that this is also ongoing in the background certainly colors some of the other instability that we do have to deal with. So just remember this whole time, warlike hurly-burly.
All right.
Are you ready for it?
Yeah.
Before we get into instability and the more complex aspects of his papacy, we're going to briefly touch on Agapetus' role in monastic reform and religious houses, because he, like his predecessors, was very interested in improving and increasing ecclesiastical discipline in religious houses. And it's a lot easier to talk about that up top.
Instead of the hurly-burly?
Yeah, the hurly-burly is going to be very hurly and burly. So this is a lot more straightforward. And with Agapetus, we have three notable examples of what he was up to with this. The first is his establishment of a Cluniac foundation at St. Paul's outside the walls. Agapetus wanted a shining example of this important monastic movement close to the heart of the church, and he wanted the very best monks to do it. And so Agapetus had contacted the abbot of the monastery at Gorze in Lorraine and requested that he send his most exemplary monks to aid in the St. Paul's outside the walls community. Now, interestingly, despite this being a Cluniac monastic community in Rome that he is trying to establish and encourage, the abbey at Gorze had actually been founded by St. Chrodegang of Metz, the founder of the Rule of St. Chrodegang that we discussed in Pope Stephen IV's episode, and Gorze was going through its own style of reform that will be known as the Gorze Reform. It has some slight differences from the Cluniac Reform, which gained them their own reputation for exceptional virtue. So in bringing the monks from Gorze to Rome to help his Cluniac project, Agapetus is ensuring a diversity of approach to monastic living, but also perhaps inspiring some like virtue competition as well for like best results. Hey, I want this to be Cluniac. I want this reform to be its best, but let's bring up this challenging reform as well and see who can out-virtue one another. And for those interested in the details of the Gorze Reform, I recommend John Nightingale's Monasteries and Patrons in the Gorze Reform book. It was very, very helpful. And at some point, we'll probably dedicate an episode specifically to the different types of late medieval monasteries so we can explore those reforms and the importance of those spaces in much greater detail, just like we did early on talking about the function of monasteries with Dr. Kramer.
Well, can we also talk about how the monastery life is represented in Brian Jacques' books with tiny animals?
That is absolutely something we could do. That's a Patreon series all in itself right there. So, that was the first example of what Agapetus is up to. Second, Aegyptus was a particular champion of the independence of monasteries and actively intervened to prevent overstepping secular leaders from, like, profiting off the labors of the monks, or, as we've seen before, straight up taking over monastic lands and holdings simply because they feel like it. We have extant letters from Pope Aegyptus preventing exactly that, ordering the Duke of Beneventum and the Duke of Capua to return properties that they had confiscated. And in similar letters, we also see him deposing the bishops of Termoli and Trevento for simony. So he's like, no, this stuff belongs to the monks. You can't sell it and you can't take it. So very, very much defending the process. And the third place that we see a particular influence of Aegyptus on religious houses is in his grant of special privilege for the Gandersheim Abbey in Lower Saxony. Gandersheim is notable for being founded in the 9th century by the Duke and Duchess of Saxony, Luitdolf and Oda, and housed the relics of Pope Anastasius I and Innocent I. But, even more notably perhaps, was because it was a Frauenstift, or home or religious community of women called secular canonesses. So these women are not nuns because they don't follow a full-on monastic rule, but were usually aristocratic unmarried women living a religious and contemplative life without permanent vows or rigorous discipline. Sounds kind of familiar, right? This sounds like the Beguines when we discussed Pope Joan.
Yes.
This is the start of that process. And like the Beguines, they could also leave at any time and get married, particularly because this way of life for women was considered very respectable. So if you went off and got married, your husband is thinking, oh, I have such a virtuous wife because she was a secular canoness.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's just like a total different look at how women's lives were in the 10th century. And at the time that Aegyptus is bestowing privilege upon the monastery of Gandersheim, it was the home of a very famous and influential secular canoness known as Hrotsvita. And Hrotsvita is cool. She is considered to be the first female writer, historian, and poet out of Germany. And historian Daniel A. Frankfurter states that she provides one of the only historical records out of the 10th century from a female perspective.
Okay.
She's cool and very noteworthy and definitely deserves her own bonus episode. I love it. And in any case, the takeaway for this episode is that Aegyptus bestowed privilege and protection on this house of secular canonesses, once again confirming that there were places of female influence in the religious sphere of medieval life, despite the long-standing myths otherwise of the Dark Ages. But now, we've got to start digging into the big stuff, because Fry, it's time for the otters. It's time to talk about King Otto, this growing power in East Francia that we've been hinting around about.
All right.
But in order to get there, we need to first check in with Hugh of Provence, who is our current king of Italy.
Ah, Hugh.
Hugh, yes. Remember Hugh? He's not doing so good.
The otter.
Well, no, this isn't the otter. This is the disastrous marriage. This is the one who hit his son during his...
Oh, that's right.
Yes.
God, it's been a long time.
Yeah. So King Hugh has not had any interference in Rome for a while, thanks to Alberic's defense of the city keeping him out, and the Pope's use of Odo of Cluny to negotiate those truces to make them stop fighting each other. But things have also not gone particularly well for him in the rest of Italy either, thanks in particular to his nephew-in-law, Berengar, the Margrave of Ivrea. This is Berengar II.
That just sounds like a fake place.
Ivra?
Yes.
I mean, it definitely has a fantasy vibe about it, for sure. So, in 940, Berengar led a revolt against Hugh, which went poorly and resulted in Berengar fleeing to the kingdom of Otto in East Francia.
There's the otters.
Yes. And Berengar's title in Ivria was abolished at this time. However, Berengar spent the next 5 years in East Francia hiring soldiers. It's important to note that he hired these soldiers. These soldiers were not provided by Otto. Otto is currently remaining neutral. So Berengar spends 5 years hiring out soldiers and then returns to Italy, where he actually defeats King Hugh in battle. Hugh was deposed as king of Italy and returned to Provence. And then Hugh's son, Lothair II of Italy, succeeded his father as king of Italy, although Berengar was very much the actual practical power at this point. And by 950, Lothair II was dead already, and generally considered to have been poisoned by Berengar, even by Flodard. So now, with Hugh and Lothair both out of the way, Berengar officially assumes the title of king as Berengar II. This is the one that Ben always cosplays as and just writes idiot across his chest.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Context. But Berengar is not a good king, as the idiot would entail. And this does not go well for anyone. As we've seen with Kings of Italy, it's usually a matter of time before the dukes and margraves just turn against you anyways. But when you're also useless and tend to alienate all the influential people around you, it's going to happen a lot quicker and with even more drama. And Berengar is rife with drama. For example, Berengar thought that the best way for him to be legitimized as king in the eyes of the Italian nobles would be to force Adelheid, the widow of Lothair, the man he likely just murdered, to marry his son and co-king, Adalbert. This at least does have some validity in its strategic thinking, because Adelheid would have been extremely legitimizing. Not just because she was married to the last, albeit brief, king of Italy, but because she was also the daughter of King Rudolf II of Burgundy, who was also king of Italy in 922. So she has ties to the kingship through lineage as well as marriage. But Adelheid was absolutely not going to consent to this marriage and tried to flee. But she was captured and imprisoned, and according to Odilo of Cluny, who wrote the famous epitaph of Adelheid, she was then tortured by Berengar and his wife Willa.
Oh.
Yeah. Quote, "The innocent Adelheid was captured by them and afflicted with diverse tortures, her flowing hair pulled out, her body frequently struck with blows from fists and feet, until finally she was confined in loathsome captivity with a single maidservant as her companion." So, like, this is not good.
No.
Let's kidnap and torture this very legitimate woman and then force her to marry our son. It's not going well.
And, like, beat her up.
Beat her up. Rip out her hair. This is definitely going to get her on board with our plan.
Right.
Fortunately, Adelheid was able to escape to Canossa, where she was able to send an envoy to the king of East Francia, Otto, for help. So this is where we're going to see this all come full circle. Now, Otto, our otter, has been very active throughout East Francia, consolidating a significant amount of power, which should not be surprising to us at this point, because we've seen several major figures of the period looking for his backing or his intervention. But when Adelheid's plea for help gets to him, he sees an incredible opportunity. Because again, she's very strategic. If he marries her, which, by the way, she is on board with, full consent, he would have a very strong and legitimate claim to the Kingdom of Italy. And if he became the King of Italy, all he'd have to do is make nice with the Pope, and then maybe they could revive that whole Holy Roman Emperor thing. So there are very compelling reasons for him to get involved here and to invade. And so Otto does invade Italy and makes very short work of Berengar, who basically gives up and agrees to pay homage to Otto. And Otto assumes the title of King of Italy, he's crowned with the Iron Lombard crown, and he marries Adelheid at Pavia. Adelheid, by the way, beyond her whole becoming empress later, she also becomes a saint and is also super badass and also worthy of her own episode. So I sense after this episode, we'll have to do...
with several bonus episodes.
Yep, about really cool, badass women of this period. So look for that. Now, you might have noticed that so far, all of this has happened without any interaction or involvement with the Pope. There's only one source, and it's Platina, that seems to suggest that Otto came to Italy on the summons of the Pope in response to Berengar having ambitions to be Holy Roman Emperor himself. But this seems very unlikely, given the more immediate motivations of Adelheid.
Mm-hmm.
However, this is the part where the Pope does get involved, because as we've already said, now as King of Italy, Otto's ambitions to be crowned emperor are no secret. So he sends two of his own bishops, the bishops of Mainz and Chur, to Rome and to the Pope, requesting a reception. And it's very likely that at this time, Pope Aegyptus was very receptive to this. But can you guess who wouldn't like this at all?
Hugh.
Oh, Hugh's dead.
Oh, you're right. No, I don't know. No idea.
Who's Hugh's enemy in the city of Rome?
Berengar.
Berengar just gave up. It's Alberic, of course. This is our master
I'm
of Rome.
I'm doing so well today.
Look, it's been a time. It's okay. Mm-hmm. We're catching everybody up on the same level. And it's Delberic, right? Our okay. master of Rome. He has kept Hugh out of the city. He has held everything in his grasp. And you may also remember that not that long ago, there was a huge assassination attempt against his life, and that had made him extra paranoid. So
that, you know, yeah. almost getting murdered would do that.
It would. And he is not in any way, shape, or form going to permit any greater power to be bestowed upon Otto, especially in Rome, where he and only he was master, right? He has the Pope under his control, and he's not going to let some other big up-and-coming rising star, super powerful man come in and have the Pope's ear. This reception is not going to happen. In the words of Horace K. Mann, quote, through the influence of Alberic, who no doubt did not want a master, Otto was given plainly to understand that he was not wanted at Rome. Now, this would normally not go well.
Okay. You're not wanted. You can't sit Ooh. With us.
Yes, exactly. Because he requested to meet with the Pope, and they're like, nope. Go away. We have no interest in you. And normally, this would be a recipe for disaster. You don't just reject the up-and-coming power.
No, that's how you get sieged.
That is how you get sieged, 100%. But Otto seemed to kind of understand that there was plenty of time to see out the rest of his ambitions. He just won a whole brand new kingdom for himself. The empire is going to follow. So rather than push this issue, he returns to East Francia with his new wife in tow and a new regent in place to protect his interests, So he's like, great, I'll come back to this. I'm going to consolidate everything, get even more powerful. Then we'll talk. So. But this is not to say that the Pope entirely snubbed Otto, because in religious matters, Aegyptus was still able to encourage Otto's increasing reach of power. He went ahead and granted Otto jurisdiction to restructure and reform monasteries across Germany, although there was some hindrance by the Archbishop of Mainz in this. And he also granted Otto's brother, the Archbishop of Cologne, a pallium. Quoting again from Horace K. Mann, "Further to Bruno, Archbishop of Cologne and the king's youngest brother, and the Alcuin of the court of Otto, he not merely granted the pallium, but the exceptional privilege of wearing it when he chose. As far as Bruno was concerned, he well deserved honor at the Pope's hands, for his one desire was to be united in word and deed with those who preserved the sound doctrine handed down from Blessed Peter the Apostle. But if Aegyptus had foreseen that Otto's dreams of universal dominion would lead him to try and enslave the church, he would probably not have been so considerate towards him."
All right. How does he feel about his Jesus sash?
He's really happy that the Jesus sash is there. He's really happy that the Pope is reaching out to him through his brother. He's like, oh, I get you. This is all about that other uppity man in Rome. You still like me. But Horace K. Mann is also telling us, like, oh, maybe Aegyptus wouldn't have been so keen on that if he knew that Otto was going to try and come over and stomp on the whole church. So that's a tease for what's to come. There is a reason that the next period is known as the Ottonian papacy.
Okay.
Yeah. But Aegyptus didn't know that, and he's just trying really hard to let Otto know that he supports him. So he also supports Otto's sending of missionaries and troops into Scandinavia, where, interestingly, Otto is said to have defeated the Scandinavian king Harald Bluetooth and converted him to Christianity. Of course, this count is disputed, but I just had to include it because this is an excellent connection to Rex Factor and Saga Thing, Harald Bluetooth. And yes, this is also where we get the name for Bluetooth technology.
What? What?
Harald Bluetooth, the runes that make up his name Bluetooth, are the ones that you see on your Bluetooth devices.
But what?
You know, the little blue symbol for your Bluetooth that has the little BK looking thing. Yeah, those are the runes of Harald Bluetooth.
But what does he have to do? What does he have to do with connecting to my phone across the house?
I mean, technically nothing, except that it's named after him. And
but why?
His runes. Yeah, I totally thought you would have known this historical fact.
No, I didn't consider the Bluetooth symbols to be runes at all.
Yeah.
What this man has to do with this, except that's what his name is.
I mean, it's sort of metaphorical. Like, short version is that, like, King Harald Bluetooth united Scandinavia, so we're uniting our devices.
No! Okay, all right.
Fry's never gonna look at Bluetooth the same way ever again.
Ugh. I'm just gonna be mad at this man when it doesn't work.
Yeah, I curse King Harald.
Like, but just sometimes I get in my car and, like, auto connects, and, like, it's definitely auto connected, but can't find it.
Oh, I know. That happens in my car too, and it drives me crazy. But now we can go King Harald. So, back to Bluetooth. Yes, he did have Bluetooth as well. Just the additional. Horace K. Mann also includes an account from Saxo Grammaticus of the king before Harald, Frode, who is now considered more to be legendary rather than historical, who specifically requested missionaries from Aegyptus at this time. So, according to the legend, quote, He also came forward to be baptized with holy water in England, which had for some while past been versed in Christianity, but he desired that his personal salvation should overflow and become general, and he begged that Denmark should be instructed in divinity by Pope Aegyptus, who was then Pope of Rome. But he was cut off before his prayers attained their wish. His death befell before the arrival of the messengers from Rome, and indeed his intention was better than his fortune, and he won as a great reward in heaven for his intended piety, as others are vouchsafed in their achievement. So, yeah, just a tie, you know, to Rex Factor and Saga thing and technology.
Yeah, I guess.
But moving on from Otto, mostly, there was one other major drama that the Pope had to contend with as a result of this shifting instability across Europe. And this once again comes back to the Sea of Reims, because of course it always comes back to the Sea of Reims lately. So we've already covered a fair bit of the tumultuous state of this bishopric. So quick recap, because it's been a while. In Pope John X's episode, we introduced Hugh of Reims, who was installed as archbishop by his father, Count Herbert of Vermandois, when he was only 5 years old. Then, in Pope John XI's episode, we covered that Hugh had been deposed as archbishop in 931 and replaced with Artold, when Pope John XI had sent a pallium to make that legitimate. Then, in Pope Stephen VIII's episode, Artold was deposed and Hugh was reinstated when his father and Hugh the Great had rebelled against King Louis IV, King Louis d'Outremer. And you might remember this because this was more recent. Pope Stephen had offered the young bishop Hugh, who was now 20 and not 5, a pallium to legitimize him again if his father reconsidered his loyalties and swore allegiance back to King Louis IV.
Complicated.
Yep, it's very complicated. And then, when all the nobles had submitted their obedience to King Louis IV, Hugh was consecrated properly as the Archbishop of Reims at a council in Soissons in 941. So, that's where we are now. During this point, Hugh, our current archbishop, who was 5 and then reinstated at 20. His father also dies. That happens along the way. Now, interestingly, according to historian Rosamond McKitterick, after being reinstated, Hugh did a relatively good job as archbishop. She also points out that he even receives praise from our well-used source, Floetard, which is surprising considering that Floetard had been deposed for refusing to participate in the installation of Hugh in the first place and had spent quite a bit of time in exile with Artold, which is Hugh's rival. So even the one who gets deposed for refusing to instill him when he's 5 years old begrudgingly admits that he was a good bishop. So this catches us up until 946. When King Louis IV, aided by King Otto, of course, regains control of Reims for yet more rebellious nobles, and in the process, deposes Archbishop Hugh again to restore Artold. So we're just going back and forth at this point.
Yep, a hurly-burly.
The hurly-burly. Artold was restored at the famous Council of Ingelheim in 948. A council that both King Louis IV and King Otto presided over with Pope Aegyptus' legate and was attended by 30 bishops. We do get a full accounting of events at the synod in Floetard, but it's not exciting and just like recounts who sat where and only briefly mentions someone getting hot. Yeah, it's not worth recounting here, but it is like someone got upset about a maybe forged letter and that was the most exciting thing that happened. So I'll just summarize. Artold was confirmed as bishop. Hugh was excommunicated for refusing to attend the council. And additionally, a mandate from Pope Aegyptus was also read, commanding all Frankish nobles to fall in line and obey King Louis IV. at the conclusion of this council, there was a little synod held in Rome in 949, where Pope Agapetus confirmed the acts of the council. So he's on side with Otto, he's on side with King Louis IV, so he wants Hugh out and Artold in, and that's where we're at. And finally, we will wrap up with a smaller issue of ecclesiastical jurisdiction in Agapetus's dealings with Pannonia, which is present-day Hungary, Austria, and Croatia. And this is kind of a weird scenario because in Pannonia, there were two bishops who claimed to be the metropolitan. We have Herhold, the bishop of Salzburg, and Gerard, the bishop of Lauriacum. And there was a reason for this dual claim beyond ambitions. Like, this is not just them being like, I want to be more powerful. Traditionally, Lauriacum had been the metropolitan diocese, but then Pannonia had been invaded by the Magyars, and Lauriacum had been badly hit, so the metropolitan authority had been transferred to Salzburg. So both of these bishops claiming this back and forth is creating a great deal of confusion through Pannonia and who they're supposed to obey, and this comes to the attention of Pope Agapetus. So the Pope wrote to the bishops and ruled that neither of them were incorrect. Both of you are right. But from that point on, Salzburg would be the metropolitan of West Pannonia, and Lauriacum would be the metropolitan of East Pannonia, including the Avars and Moravians. So they cut the baby in two and gave them both what they wanted. But it worked. It was a lot more stable as a result. But then Pope Agapetus died on November 8th of 955. Wendy J. Reardon claims that Agapetus died, quote, mysteriously of unknown causes, but it seems more likely that he was dying some kind of natural illness, given that there's a whole bunch of political machinations that play out here. You see, when Agapetus fell ill, Alberic, the patrician of Rome, is also dying at the same time. They are both sick and dying at the same time. And Alberic is not prepared to give up control of Rome, even in death. So he comes to the Pope, who is also dying, and forces him to openly declare that Alberic's son, Octavian, would succeed him as Pope, and then to compel the church to make sure they'd comply.
Okay.
Do you remember how this goes?
No, it sounds like it's going to go bad.
It's such a bad thing. This is a no-no. As per the ruling of Pope Symmachus, it is entirely illegal to discuss papal succession during the lifetime of a pope, and the church has been aggressively against the pope appointing their own successor. They do not like this. The last time this happened was in 530 when Pope Felix IV fell ill and he had publicly endorsed his deacon, Boniface, to be his successor and compelled the clergy to elect him in an attempt to prevent political division. You might remember, or not, that at this point the clergy then actively rejected Boniface in the election, with like 60 to 70 bishops voting for the deacon Dioscorus instead. And that Dioscorus would have been, at that point, the legitimately elected pope had he not immediately died, causing the clergy to compromise with Boniface anyways. And that's why Dioscorus gets a anti-pope episode instead of the other way around. However, this is the Seculum Obscurum, and the papacy is still very much in Alberic's control, even though he does end up dying before Agapetus. So this time, we don't see the same sort of outrage or resistance that we would have before, and Octavian will be our next pope. So we'll have a lot more to say about him in our next episode. Agapetus was buried in the apse of the Lateran, not St. Peter's, but his tomb was still destroyed in a fire in either 1308 or 1361. After the fire, the recovered remains were collected and buried in a polyandrum and reinterred in the basilica near the tomb of Innocent III. no epitaph survives.
Oh.
So that is the end of Pope Agapetus II. And now it's time to rate him.
Okay.
Are you ready?
No.
It's been a while since we've done this.
Papatum Infallium.
So he establishes the Cluniac/Gorze monastic community at St. Paul's outside the walls and protects the Abbey of Gandersheim and its unique position with the Frauenstift. He confirms the council at Ingelheim, so he's trying to bring some stability to the Bishopric of Frauens. Beyond that, he's still very much under control of Alberic. There's not a lot of papally authority going on here.
Yeah. Can we give him like a 2?
Like a 2 total?
Yeah.
Or, yeah, I could see that. A 1 each. It's like he's not doing a bad job, but he's just not really able to do much. And most of what he does do, at least, is mostly in the realm of secular impact. So.
Fructus prohibitum.
We have to take it seriously that he openly confirmed support for his papal successor. Yes, he was forced, but this is still illegal under canon law, especially from a pope. So it's worth a point or two.
Yeah, I'm only leaning towards like 1 again.
Mm-hmm. I think so. I mean, if it's just, you know, because then we have, I'm also going to give him a 1 and then he'll end up with a 2. It's not great, but again, of all the things that happen in this time period, it does seem pretty low-key.
Seculari impactum.
So here, again, he doesn't really have much impact. He's trying to have an impact here. He's present for a major shift in the Kingdom of Italy, and with Otto's assumption of power, he doesn't have any direct involvement with it, thanks to Alberic, but he is trying to still find a way to showcase his support. So there's that.
Okay.
What do you think? Is it another 2?
Yeah, I think we're at another 2.
I think so. It's just consistently, like, an effort was made.
There's a little bit, like, he's a good trier, I guess.
He is a good trier, but he doesn't really get the opportunity to showcase anything. Are you ready to look at this man's face?
Yep.
Fossium Sanctus.
It's, something.
Why has he got so, why is his eyebrows go on forever?
Okay, there's kind of a dark shading. I'm going to send you another version of this by comparison.
It's not better.
It almost looks like he's wearing eyeshadow.
Yeah.
And then there's, in the more high-def version, there's also something sort of beaded that's right on the edge of his beard that could be a dangly earring.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. It could be a dangly earring. Or a necklace.
It could be.
What am I looking at?
Like, is he just really fancy?
Oh.
What do we think?
Okay, so like his beard is really meticulous.
It is. And that mustache is really like sharp.
Uh-huh.
And put together.
And his hair, he doesn't even have like a tonsure.
He doesn't. You're right. There is no bunny poof. There is no tonsure. He is a full head of hair with like defined curls around the edges.
Mm-hmm.
This is a man who looks after his appearance.
Yeah. Clearly, that's all he's been doing.
He's been too busy primping to actually act as Pope.
Look how primped up he is.
He's very primped up.
His eyebrows are doing something.
Yeah, they are a little bit shaped. They are, again, defined. He's put some makeup on. I'm going to send you a couple more of the bad images because, again, he has really shaped, defined brows.
Oh, that one's bald, though. I think he would be ashamed.
That one is bald. Yeah, I feel like his appearance is important to him.
Mm-hmm.
He's trying to be a fancy man, and we need to rate him accordingly.
I think I need to give him a 7 for all that effort he put in.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
He tried.
Yeah. He really did. It's a look. There's definitely a lot going on. I did not think initially that he was going to rate this high, but the more I look at it, the more details pop out of this thing. Yeah, I'm definitely seeing it. So I think I'll give him a 5. I don't know if I can go as high as your 7, but that will give him a 12. And when scored out, that gives him a nice round 3, which is cool.
We have seen so many popes who have not given a single shit about how they look in these paper portraits.
You're absolutely correct. Yeah, this is a special one. Who would have thought? I love it.
Tempus Pontificus.
So May 10th, 946 to November 8th, 955, 9.5 years and a score of 2.375. He's getting most of his points through how long he was Pope and how much he cared about his appearance.
He cared a lot.
He did. And canon bonus round is next.
All right, everybody, it's the canon bonus round.
And I really wish he was, because we could make him the saint of, like, primping and making yourself look beautiful, but no. That's just not.
It's unfortunate. Sometime we'll have to go through all of these guys and, like, give them what their patron sainthood would have been had they been a patron saint.
Oh, that is definitely a Patreon episode for when we hit the halfway mark. We could do that.
Yay.
All right. So that brings us to his total score, which is an 11.375.
Not the worst.
Not the worst, and better than our last Pope, Marinus II. Not better than our second last Pope. But yeah, we've been running in the last 5 popes, we've had an 11.5, 11.75. Yeah, he's definitely where he belongs. So that means I probably already know the answer to the next question. But Fry, do you think this pope is papally enough, pizzazzy enough, with an impact enough for a papal bull?
Oh, I'm sorry. No.
No. That earring just isn't enough. It's flashy, but it's not bull-worthy.
Uh-uh.
So that brings us to the end of our episodes, and we have some thank yous to make because
it's been a while.
It's been a while. We went on hiatus, and you guys showed up during that time. So huge, huge thanks to our patrons who need to be absolved of their temporal punishments. Thank you to William Holleran, Simon Fichtel, Phoenix, Bean Goblin, Ares Arbel, Greg Muzan, William Zinitz, and Paul L.
Ego te absolvo.
I also need to thank Dr. Barry Torch, who's been absolutely fantastic in offering sources and helping us get sources and having access to things that I absolutely wouldn't have access to otherwise, which is going to make the early modern period so much easier to research. And I'm very excited about that.
Amazing.
Also, a special thank you to Amy Collette, who surprised me today. A boom arm for my microphone just arrived from the Amazon wishlist. Thank you so much. That is so very sweet. I'm so excited to set it up. The next episode will be the first one recorded without a mic directly in my face for me to hit all the time.
But at least when you're smacking it, I know you're near it.
Oh, yes. And I gesticulate when I talk, so. Who am I kidding that I'm not going to hit it on a boom arm? But it will be so much more comfortable, and I'm so excited about it. So thank you so much. And with that, we can also say thank you so much for sticking with us during our short hiatus. Thank you for all of the support, the outcry of love, and wonderful support from my co-host, who I adore. Thank you, guys. Thanks for sticking with us.
Yes, thank you so much.
And we'll see you next time.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye.
Pontifax is edited by Greg Gassman. Greg is the host of the fabulous papal history podcast, Popular History, where you can also find cardinal numbers, ranking the cardinals of the Catholic Church, and coming up soon, Habemus Pointsum, where Greg and I will discuss all of the papal transitions that he loves so much. If you need to reach Greg, you can do so at popularhistory@gmail.com. Get it? It's like popular, but with an E for the popes.
If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can reach us at pontifexpod@gmail.com. And we're PontifexPod on all social media platforms. If you'd like to support the show, consider subscribing to Pontifex on Patreon. Checking out our research wishlist at tinyurl.com/pontifexwishlist or making a one-time donation at paypal.me/pontifexpodcast. If you'd like to support us in other ways, rating and reviewing the show on iTunes makes a world of difference.